Osiris.
Hey everyone, it's Cam Hurt, host of the Best Show Ever podcast, and we have got a second season coming out very soon that I am very excited about. We've got some very cool special guests, including musical acts that we all love, like Karina Reichman, Daniel Donato, Jake Brownstein from Eggy, Rick and Peter from Goose, and many more. Tune in for new episodes dropping on Osiris Media March 5th on the Best Show Ever podcast.
Hey everybody, we're off for another few weeks, but I would like to bring you a very special rebroadcast of our original episode featuring the blues man legend himself, Bobby Rush. And why are we bringing back this special episode? Well, it is his 87th birthday today. And I have to be honest with you guys, I've talked to over 150 artists on this show, and this may be one of my all-time favorite conversations. And so many people did not hear this yet, so I wanted to bring it to you again. So, I grew up in Chicago listening to a lot of blues music with my dad, and Bobby may be one of the last living legends who actually played with icons like Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf. And you know what? He has never stopped creating. He has put out his 27th studio record, Rawer Than Raw, this year, and was nominated for another Grammy Award. As artists, we are inherently doubtful about our own abilities. We question whether anyone will ever recognize if our songs are worth listening to. If you ever think about giving up, take a look at Bobby Rush's career. He recorded 370 recordings over 60 years before he was nominated and then won a Grammy Award at 83 years old. As much as I hate saying it, it is still not safe to play music live right now in person, so you can go online and watch Bobby accept the Crossroads of American Music Award presented by the Grammy Museum Mississippi on November 12th. Check it out if you can. Bobby is not your average 87-year-old. He can still kick ass live, and I really love watching him play. And as much as I would love to wax poetic about the amazing win over tyranny that happened in our country last week, I will ask you instead to go on Bobby Rush's Instagram. Yes, 87-year-olds have Instagram. And check out the moving post he put up about the late, great John Lewis. On March 7th, 1965, John Lewis, Martin Luther King Jr., and a group of civil rights activists and peaceful protesters were marching across the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama, and they were beaten down brutally by the white police force as the whole world watched on television. You have to remember that this is not that long ago. This is when my father was 10 years old, and not long after the governor of Alabama, George Wallace, was running for president in the primaries of 1964 under the slogan "Segregation Now and Segregation Forever." Now, we may have moved on a bit from those times, and yet this election felt reminiscent of those days. Would our country accept an openly white supremacist president to return for a second term? The answer is no. And while many people have not accepted that as I record this, the answer, thankfully, was no. A record 74 million people said, no, we will not allow this in this country. And yet, 70 million people said yes. And I'm super privileged to be able to talk to people like Bobby Rush, who was around playing music in those days. The type of good old days where Bobby would have to play behind a curtain so people wouldn't have to see who was playing at an upscale restaurant outside Chicago. And yet, as you'll hear, there is no bitterness in Bobby's voice. He's always moving forward. I want to say thanks again to Bobby for sharing his stories with me, and thanks to all of you around the world who've been listening to this show for the last 2 years. Yes, it's our two-year anniversary this month, and we will be coming back with brand new episodes very soon. Please subscribe, share with your friends, and leave us a review on iTunes if you can. I'm going to play you just a little bit of his new song, Shake It For Me. It's the song playing underneath me right now, and then I will bring you our original episode with Bobby Rush. Enjoy.
Sing it one time for me. I done found me a woman. Shake like the leaf shaking on the tree. Well, you went away, baby. Got back a little too late. Well, you went away, baby. Got back a little too late. Well, I done found me another woman. Shake like jelly on the plate. Oh, shake it. Shake baby. Shake it one time for me. I done found me a woman.
You don't look like you're in your 80s.
Oh, come on.
So it's like, I assume that you were playing with guys, you know, like
my
Taj
manager
Mahoma.
Must have sent you some money to say that, you know, he paid you to say that. No,
How young are you?
I've been around for a long time. Let me give you a little story about Bobby Rush. I was born in a little place called Homer, Hainesville, Louisiana. I left my little hometown in 1947. Mm. In 1948, when I met Little Walter. Then I moved to Pine Bluff, Arkansas, where I met Elmo James and formed a band called the Four Jivers in 1949.
Little Walter was still down?
Yes, in Louisiana.
That was before Juke and all the...
Oh, yeah, before that.
For the hits, yeah.
Yeah, for the hits. We all migrated. He went there a little before I did, but I went in 1951 to Chicago. When I got to Chicago, Willie Dixon was there, Little Walter was there, Jimmy Reed was there, Bo Diddley was there, but he didn't come to Chester 53. Pink Meat Mark and my Mabel were there, and Smokey Hall, John Lee Hooker didn't come to 56. Howlin' Wolf come in 56. Etta Jane come in 1957, and so did Buddy Guy come in 1957. Pick Me Markham, and Mom Mabel come in 54, so did Bo Diddley.
Wasn't a lot of people living, like Willie Dixon, at Muddy Waters' house?
Oh, yeah. Well, he had a couple of houses, something kind of like the band house.
Yeah, it was like the clubhouse.
Yeah, clubhouse. He was like in the back of the old club, and you come out the club and go into this house of his, and it was his house and his residential house where he stayed when the musician didn't run him out. It was one of them kind of things.
That migration to Chicago was amazing, the amount of people who all came up within the 10-year period.
Well, I'm old enough to know the migration from Mississippi in Chicago, from Alabama, and a lot of Louisiana would migrate to L.A., West.
Oh, interesting.
Most of the people from the Mississippi Delta side migrated to Chicago. But it wasn't a one trip. It was migrated from the Delta to Memphis to East St. Louis. Not St. Louis, St. Louis to Chicago. Mm. That was the migration because the bus ticket was too high. The bus ticket was $9, so we didn't have enough money to buy it all the way.
So you did it in stages.
Doing the stages. And you worked on the street and playing like we did at Jewtown, Muddy Waters. And I didn't play there that much as Little Walter and I did.
You know? Built your first guitar, right?
I built my first guitar, the Diddley Bow, they call it. But I call it just a string. I got a whipping by my guitar. I built my guitar out of a broom wire, and we only could get the broom wire after the broom wore out. So my dad bought this new broom. I think he paid about 60 cents for this broom back in 1948, 49. And I didn't have a broom. My mom said, well, you have to wait until we wear the broom out so you can get the wire off the broom and make you another guitar after I broke the wire. So I didn't want the baling wire with the bale hay because it's too heavy. I didn't want that doom, so I want that deer, you know, like the Elmo James stuff. So my dad bought this broom. I said, can I have this wire for the broom? She said, yeah, when the broom wear out. It takes about 4 or 5 weeks to broom wear out with sweeping whatever.
So you had to wait.
So I went and got this broom, and we had this horse trough. So I went and wet this broom and stuck it in the horse trough and got it real wet. And then I went down to the cow pen, and I called a couple of cows. Cow? And they chewed the old broom up, and I went back and told my mother.
So you cheated a little bit.
Yeah, I cheated. Can I have this? Oh, yeah, you can have the broom. It's wore out. Cow had ended up, you know. But anyway, I made the broom, took the wire off the broom, made it, and I had a brick at the top and a ball at the bottom, so it gave a different kind of sound. Until one day the brick fell off and hit me in the head. And it started bleeding on me. So I reversed the brick at the bottom and the ball at the top. That's came the sound. And I called Elmo James. I said, Elmo James, I have your sound. So how you have it? Because I reversed it. And it sounded like an Elmo James, like a Dust My Room thing. That was the start of Bobby Rush guitar thing, you know.
And your father, your father was a pastor?
Bobby was a preacher in the pastor's church, and he was a guitar player. I didn't know he played guitar. I was about 8 years old. My cousin gave me a guitar, and I hid it from my dad, I thought. Hid it in the loft in the barn. And the sun got real hot, and the neck of the guitar twisted. So every few days, I would come down. Like the neck, the string was this high from the neck. But I would put in this water, and the neck would straighten out. You know, overnight, when I put it back up in the loft, a couple of days, it'll bow back up again. But anyway, my daddy told me one day, he said, Junior, I'm a junior, I'm not about my father. I said, yes, sir. He said, bring that guitar here, boy. Oh, I was afraid he gonna take the guitar, give me a whooping about it. Because I hadn't planned to play no gospel at all. My blues was on my head and mind. My daddy said, he tuned it up. I didn't know he could play it at all. He wasn't a great guitar player, but to me, that's all I had. That's all I knew. Great to me. He started playing. He said, I'm going to play a song to you, boy. I used to play for a little girl when I was a little older than you. I was about 8 years old. I wanted to hear it because I know he's going to play either by my mama. I play Glory, Glory, Hallelujah, when I laid my burden down. But he didn't play either one of those. He said, me and my gal went to Chanky Pin hunting. She fell down and I saw something. I said, wow. My daddy and a preacher too.
Yeah. Well, every preacher has a past.
Yeah. He said, me and my gal went to Chanky Pin hunting. She fell down and I saw something. I said, and my mama said, like, don't say that to that boy. So I kept talking to my dad about, I said, Dad, I said, sing it again. What I want my dad to do is sing the next verse. Now, I know the first verse, she fell down. He saw something. And next verse should tell me what he saw. I couldn't ask my daddy what he saw. You know, I'm a little kid. So he said, my mother would say, and my dad went to sing it again. I said, Dad, how big was she? He said, oh, she was fat, 350 pound boy. I said, yeah. I said, what she had on? He's nothing but a dress. In my little mind, I went to ask my daddy what he saw, this big fat woman. But I couldn't ask him, but I could imagine in my mind a big fat lady falling down, 350 pounds, with nothing on but a dress.
Yeah.
Man, my little mind was gone. I said, sing it again, Dad. He went to sing it again, and my mama was coming. I said, Dad, here come mama. He said, me and my gal with the chanky pin hunting. He looked around. She fell down, and I kept running. That's, I'd never know what the song was going to be. But from that on, I knew what I wanted to be, a blues singer, man. That was it.
Well, it gets your mind worrying about stuff.
Well, yeah, you know, because it's a lot of guys influenced me, but that was the biggest influence of my life. Being a preacher and my dad, he never told me to sing the blues, but he never told me not to.
Well, the thing is, back then, right, this is before TV was really a thing.
And plus, the gospel thing, most guys, but that was like the devil music. You know, you would dare to do that. But my dad, being a preacher, never told me not to sing it.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Well, he probably loved it deep down, right?
He probably did, but he never told me to sing it. But he never told me not to.
Well, there's a lot of artists that I grew up, you know, listening to that I got into recently again. Sister Rosetta Tharpe.
And
you know, people like that who come from this sort of religious
background.
Sort of a tent revival singer background, but then crossed over into sort of this rock and roll blues world. And
well, be honest,
so many people came
be honest with
from
you,
that.
Zach, if you look back at it, what I do, what Rosetta Tharpe did and a lot of us did, we were doing the same thing. On a Saturday night, we said, baby, baby, baby. On a Sunday night, you said, Jesus, Jesus, Jesus. It's the same music. The same music.
I mean, there's a certain point where if you want to reach a larger audience,
you need to go beyond
the church.
Yeah, well, they call it the crossover. You cross through secular stuff, you know. But the same people you saw on Saturday night, the same people you see Sunday morning, the same people Sunday morning, the same people Saturday night.
Atoning for their sins from Saturday night at the Roadhouse.
And sometimes the bigger sins than others, you know, depending on how much you drink, you know.
And you did something kind of atypical where you went to Chicago and then you went back to Jackson, Mississippi,
I went
to
Chicago and stayed 48 years in Chicago, and I went there and got all of my, I thought I got all the things that I learned. Didn't learn it all, but I learned a lot of things. I learned what I shouldn't have done.
Yeah.
Then I went back to the southern state where I was come from. Mm-hmm. I went back to Mississippi where my great-grandparents were from Mississippi. But I didn't go back just because of Mississippi. I went back, if you look on the map of the southern states, Mississippi is the center point mm-hmm. of the state. I was living in Chicago, working 80% of my gig was in the southern state. Mm. So what I was doing, working Friday, Saturday, Sunday in the Mississippi area, the southern soul area, which is south.
The Chitlin Circuit.
Chitlin Circuit. And going back to Chicago on a Monday, getting there on a Tuesday, staying in Chicago Tuesday and Wednesday, leaving out on Thursday, coming back south.
That's a long drive.
That was a long drive. I was spending all my time driving back and forth. So I said, no, let me find out what I can do. So I moved to the southern state so I could be home Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, and leave out on Friday morning, sometime Thursday night, and be home.
Make the road more efficient.
Make it more efficient and be with the kids and the whole bit, you know.
What was, I'm from Chicago.
Rudy?
And my dad, you know, kind of would go see Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf and all those guys in the 60s, 70s.
Well, you're awful young to know about these.
70s, rather, 70s.
Yeah.
And it was sort of a part of my upbringing, you know, just sort of that music. And I was always a bit jealous of him that he got to go and hang out with these guys. Well, at that time, he was like, yeah, Muddy Waters was just a guy who would play at the cafe at, like, Northwestern
like
University.
Old Bobby Rush is now, you know?
But I was like, now I think, there's, like, these legends that sort of are put into, the blues myth, you know? But back then, you could kind of go to the cafe and see him playing for $5, you know?
Yeah, it's the first time, well, not the first time I met Muddy Waters, I went to Apex in Chicago, 1951 or 52. I was able to get this job at this place where Muddy didn't want to work there, but Jay Billenor got the number from Muddy Waters to give me, and I worked at this place where behind a curtain, where people wanted to hear our music, didn't want to see our face. Mm. But I remember as a band leader, I was making $3 and some dollars or $3.50 a night. As a band leader sometimes, $5. And I got this gig out in Roseland. Mm. The man paid me $7 a night, and I hired Muddy Waters for $5.50 a night.
You hired him?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Muddy Waters worked by. You know, I was making $7.
Were you playing harp with him and he was singing, or you were both singing?
No, I was a band leader. I never played. I played a many time on the stage with him, but I never played with no one. Mm. I come out the door playing with my own band at 13 or 14 years old. Mm. You know, I had my first band I put together was Elmo James on guitar, then Freddie King. I was young, didn't know what I was doing, but I had the amplifiers, Sis Roebuck amplifiers. Mm. Silver tones, but I was the worst player in the band, but I owned all equipment, so couldn't nobody fire me.
as a fellow band leader, I appreciate the acknowledgement that sometimes you can be the worst musician,
but
you're indispensable to the band at the same time.
But I was
write the songs.
I write the song, and I was the business, but I had the station wagon, man,
yeah.
You know, and I had the credit, you know, I could go get it, you know, because I had this little day job I could do, and I had people who believed in me, you know, like credit-wise, you know, to let me have an amplifier for this $50 amplifier. I mean, I could go with the credit. Well, sometimes other guys couldn't even have the credit to get it with, you know.
Tell me again about that playing behind the curtain situation.
Oh, at that time, I really was dumb to the fact of what they was trying to do to me. Discrimination. I didn't understand it, but Jay Billenor did. Because he wouldn't do it. You know, J.B. always talked about new racial songs and presidential thing. He always talked about, but I didn't. He said to the man, I learned later, he told the man, he said, listen, I can't do it, but I got a guy who will do it for you. Mm-hmm. So who is it? Bobby Rush. And he the one got me the gig. Because he knew that I didn't know about the curtain. It was cool to me because at that time, I'm a young man who played behind a curtain, and I wanted my girlfriend on the stage. I had this behind the curtain, they couldn't see what I was doing. I would play a little and feel fumble a little. You know, like I had the girls behind the curtain with me.
Yeah.
You know, because we would come in through the back door behind the curtain. The audience never saw me until I got so friendly with the guy. ladies and gentlemen, we've been listening to the music from Bobby Rush and his band. And they would open the curtain up like that, would take a bow, and they would close it back up. But the band, and someone complained to him, somebody complained to him by seeing and using the N-word, seeing us.
And this is in Chicago?
Yes, suburbs of Chicago. Oh God, yeah, man.
What did they think you looked like?
Well, they knew they didn't want to see it. They didn't want to hit the audience, didn't want to see who we were because they didn't want whoever their girlfriend or who they brought with them. They didn't want nobody to be listening to no black guys playing behind it. That's why we're behind
That's
the
so
curtain.
So weird, man.
But he said, okay, Bobby Rush. Said, what I'm gonna do tomorrow? I'm gonna put another curtain on the stage. He put another curtain on the stage, put the band behind this curtain. I'm in the front of the curtain. Now, when I take a bow, he can't see the band. They only see me. Mm. So, ladies and gentlemen, Bobby Rush, he would open it up, and he never see it. So, you wouldn't see the black band now. Okay. They only see me. I did that for a couple of times until a guy came up, Chinese guy came up from Rush Street in Chicago and saw me and wanted to take me down the loop to play on Rush Street. And I can tell you on record, I'm probably one of the first black men to play on Rush Street in Chicago back in the early 50s. Your next person would be probably be Red Fox, Sammy Davis Jr., Dick Gregory.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you feel like there was a divide about when the civil rights movement started kicking into full gear of the African-American artists who wouldn't play segregated audiences and ones who wanted to make a living and had to do it? Because I just saw an amazing play about Nat King Cole and about sort of his journey of sort of becoming the first sort of, you know, TV star and wanting to be able to reach everyone, you know, not just be relegated to the black audience, but found that a lot of the civil rights leaders wanted him to step up and to speak out about this, but he's like, "But I want to make a living." And there's this divide about, and it still carries over today. Like, do you stand up for what's right, or do you show people your work and let them
speak
decide?
For itself.
Yeah, and that's tough.
But I'm about to tell you something that's really going to be really shocking to you and the world. Last year, I had the box set of the year.
Mm-hmm. The Grammys.
The Grammys. Mm-hmm. Grammys were one thing, but the box set of the year, I mean, the reason that some of that came about because the box set of the year is the masters.
Mm-hmm.
Because I own the masters of most of those things.
Smart.
That I cut. Because I believe I'm the only man ever kind of recorded in the 50s at Chess and left with the masters.
How did you figure that out?
I'm going to tell you, this is what I'm telling you now, never been on tape before.
Okay.
Because you're looking at a man who now, I talk about it now, it's a lot of men have been this road that I'm on. But most men who have traveled the road I travel is dead and gone.
Mm-hmm.
Including Sam Cooke, the Red Fox, the Sammy Davis Jr., the Tyrone Davis, the Prince, and on in Michael Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
50, 100 years from now, you'll find out really why they died.
Mm.
I escaped the rope because I was too small for one thing, not big enough for another. So no, they looked over me.
It's almost like when the dinosaurs all went extinct, the ones that survived were the little ones that could get under the dirt.
I was one that said, "Oh, I didn't know about Bobby Rush and his soul blues singer."
Well, but there's something to be said about your continued hard work.
Well, it's hard work, but then
you never stopped.
That was some love was shared to me by who. Even the Chess brother thought I was involved in because I could pretty much do what I want to do. Let me tell you a little why. Because I was a friend of Al Capone's brother.
In Chicago.
So when people saw me coming, they thought I was tied in with Al Capone. I didn't really know the man. But I use that for my to my advantage to do the thing. Like once I oh that's like a bomb. Whatever.
Yeah, you don't want to mess with Bobby.
Yeah, you know, yeah. So I got by with a lot of things. Didn't even know the man, but I did know his brother. His brother knew me, and he taking care of me. That's why I worked downtown. I got in this because I was working. I don't want to get into name calling, but that was a Chinese guy called Kunch.
Okay.
I was working at Bourbon Street. So I went to him and said, "Listen, I'm going to the swing club because you paying me $5.50 a night. I can get $12 a night as a band leader at swing club." And he said, "Okay." So I'm giving you a 2-week notice. He said, "Thank you, man. You're awful nice to let me know, and I get somebody else." So I went to this other club to work, not knowing it's tied up, not knowing this Capone, did not know nothing about this. I went to work. So the guy said, "Oh, you go to the office and get your money." Went up there to get my money after I worked 4 days. Mm-hmm. And I went to the same office that I went before. Mm-hmm. And he turned around with the cigar, the same guy. He kept me. He said, "Hey, kid, you're a good kid. I like you. We're going to make a lot of money, kid." I said to him, I said, "Depending on what I got to do." "So you don't tell me what to do, you do what the hell I tell you to do." Now I realize I quit one job, go to the next job, and it's the same man all them all. So I was in because I respected him to tell him no, to notice I was going there, what I was going to do, same man hired me. So right then, I was locked in.
Well, businessman recognizes another businessman, right? I was listening to the Chicken Heads 50-year history of Bobby Rush, the boxing.
Yeah, yeah.
And some of those old songs hold up, man. The Gotta Have Money song. Right?
Oh, yeah.
I love that line, "The money is the root of all evil."
Yeah, yeah.
"And I got the fever."
Yeah. "Call the doctor. I got a fever because I want it, you know."
Yeah.
"I'm sick about it, you know."
Well, you know. Tell me how you tried to overcome the sort of unfairness of those earlier days.
Through my dad's teaching and through my biblical study. I'm a blues singer, but I'm a biblical study. Not a religion nut, but I'm a biblical study because the Bible is a roadmap to my life.
Mm.
And I think as many other people's life, it's a roadmap. And I always have known, especially now, that many things have changed, but most things have changed, remain the same.
Mm.
And nothing is new under the sun. Everything was, it is, everything is, it was.
Mm.
And I knew that coming up as a kid, coming through the racial stuff, coming through the ups and downs, honor, privilege, and most of the things was did to me, most of the things that was done to me, I did it to myself, not knowing what to do for myself.
Mm.
You follow me?
Mm-hmm.
Now, don't get me wrong, that was some opportunity that wasn't there for me as a black man, but I knew that too.
Mm-hmm.
Because I remember me and Freddie King went to Mendota, Illinois in the early 60s. I had a guy on the guitar named Willie James, was married to a white lady.
Mm-hmm.
And we went in the club, and a guy came up and said, and used the N-word. Mm-hmm. He said, and didn't mean no harm about it. I can tell what he was talking. He said, "Listen, you N-word, y'all sure can play. I love this music you play."
Yeah.
And he just went on to say, "You so-and-so, something, you know, the N-word. I love you, you N-words. Man, y'all can play."
Yeah.
And he would stick something in my pocket. Willie James, who was married to a white lady, was mad enough to fight. He said, "Man," I said, "be cool, be cool. If you want to quit, quit tomorrow. We're going to play tonight. I'll do go home." He kept sticking something in my pocket. At that time, getting $1.50 was a big tip for us because we wasn't getting but $7-$8 a night. He went down and we was playing a song, stuck it in his pocket. He did it 4 or 5 times.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't look at it. I figured I'm going to get me $4 or $5. I'm going to get everybody $1 a piece.
Mm-hmm.
But it was $100 bills.
Wow.
I had about $600. Now, I didn't tell the band at the time what it was, so I got changed for $100 bill, and I gave everybody $20 a piece, and I kept the rest of the money. And I'm the band leader anyway, you know. So that was a lot of money. Who we making $7 a night, man? And get the guys, couple of days like that went by, and I'm getting guys, and I made $100. Wow. You know, Freddie Will was happy about that. Sunday night came, this same man was calling us the N-word, shooting pool. Now, he's sober. He don't pay us any attention. We're playing his song, supposedly, because we wanted to come do the tip now.
Yeah.
So Freddie King said, hey, sir. We played the song about 4 or 5 times.
Which song? Shoot
Freddie King, on the Hideaway, before we recorded now. Mm-hmm. Hideaway was, because we had, this long story about Hideaway. That was Magic Sam's song for 10 or 15 years
before. How's that song go?
Hideaway.
Yeah.
You know, the Hideaway.
Yeah.
The old Freddie King Hideaway. And well, he was playing this song, and the guy wasn't paying us any attention. So Freddie said, Willie James, call the guy. So he said, hey, sir, the N-word is over here. You know, we want this tip now.
Yeah.
Oh, but 2 days ago, we was mad. He was mad about wanting to fight about the guy.
Right.
Now the guy not paying his attention. He wanted to come over and put some more money in the pocket. Anyway, that's a story where the guy's using the N-word and you're mad about it. Now he pays for this relationship that he had built with us. Now he don't pay us any attention on the Sunday night. We want him to come over and call us out again so he can get some more money. Anyway, that's one of them situations, you know. But yeah, but you know, speaking about me as a racial thing, I was brought up a little bit different from a lot of people. Coming from Louisiana, my parents from Mississippi, my mom. My mom had 10 children.
Wow.
And she was my mom who was in home a lot of time, who was out in the public. She was our babysitter. Because my mom is blonde hair and blue eyes.
Mm.
And my dad is dark, black as from Africa.
Mm.
And he was my mom's chauffeur a lot of time when he had to be.
How did your parents meet?
I don't know. I know, but it's a long story. My grandfather, great grandfather, from Vicksburg, Mississippi, and so my great grandmama.
Mm-hmm.
She lived with a guy called Van Spivey, which is a white guy, as a slave. It was he had 6 kids by his wife, and 5 by my great grandmama. And living in the same house. So I was told when he got sick on his dying bed, he wanted to split his money and land to his children.
Mm-hmm.
And the oldest child was 19.
Mm.
He didn't want to split it between his black sister and brother. So he took them, which was my great-grandmama, took them to Eudora, Arkansas.
Mm.
They raised themselves in a barn. That's where my dad met my mom.
I mean, that's got to be, you know,
my mom.
That's an early education about figuring out how to make it work.
So I didn't come up knowing about have to work in the field for some white guy who owned the field. I worked all day for no money, but with my daddy's deal, because you got to understand, my mama blew that blonde hair.
She
made the deals for us, so I didn't know anything about working for nobody, but my mama did it for no money.
But your dad was a public figure in the community. And did they think it was weird that your mom looked white?
But my dad played the role what he had to play. I didn't know about the other situation with it.
Mm.
But I can remember when I was about 6 or 7, must have been about 6, she went down to this store that my dad was getting some hay in this wagon. I was in the back of this wagon shooting marbles. And 2 men rode up on a horse. One was leading the horse. There were 3 men. My mother named Maddie. They said, Maddie, so what you doing with this nigger? And my mother said, I'm a nigger too.
Mm.
Just like that. She said, no. He said, you don't believe it? Ask Mr. Bear. Mr. Bear was on store owner. So when my mama left me in the store, and I could tell she said, stay here till I come back, she left me as a babysitter, not as a mama, not her son.
Yeah.
When she went in the store, I saw my mom was another kind of woman. Now, when she went in the store, she was a white woman.
Mm.
And I can tell what she shuffled and
a little more power.
Oh, she went in, she talked with this. She was this white woman in the store. Mm. And when she told them who her dad was, these men left. That was my great granddad. Mm. You follow me? And when they found out who she was, and she came back, my dad never knew anything. Mm. And I didn't know then either. I just found out later, you know. Whatever she told them in the store, they knew the story of my great granddaddy. Mm. Whoever he was this.
It's interesting that you mentioned Eudora, Arkansas.
Yeah.
Do you know, you ever heard of this artist, Tony Joe White?
Yes.
I had him on the podcast right before he died, actually. Yeah. And amazing kind of swamp blues guitar player, singer. Yeah. He has this song about his parents going to see the devil at the jail in Eudora, Arkansas. That supposedly, you know, as entertainment.
Yeah, yeah.
The families would be told that they had caught the devil and they had him in this jail. Yeah. And that it wasn't necessarily that they all believed it, but it was like, we're going to go see for ourselves if the devil is really there. And that his parents would come back and they were scared. Like they were like, they believed
it. You know? Tony was a good friend of mine before he passed.
Oh, man.
It's, you know.
I'm so sad.
Pokes out of Atlanta. That's my buddy, man, you know.
Neither of you have any gray hairs on your head.
Yeah, I have some gray hair. I got Clairol in it. I got some gray hair all around the edges, man. Yeah. But I tell it like it is.
How do you remember lyrics from songs you wrote 50 years ago?
I was talking about this last night. Every night, every day, I thank God at 377 records, I remember most of them. Mm. But it's not nothing that I do. It's just a blessing that I remember the songs pretty well. Well, I wrote them all, too, you know. Mm. I may not remember line by line a lot of time, but when I get to singing them, they all come back. You know, they all kind of come back, you know.
If there was a song that you would play, you know, every day for the rest of your life, what would that song be?
Probably be Chicken Heads.
That was the hit, the first hit, right?
Probably Chicken Head. That was a song I've been playing. There's several things I talk about. You know, I like a lot of things that I've done, but the thing that sticks in my mind, the thing that I love the most, is a song like Making a Decision. Making a decision sometimes sure can be hard. Making a decision for yourself is different when you got kids involved. Mm. Making a decision about a juvenile cry is different when it's your own child, because kissing and can and hurts don't cry, don't make a grown man smile. Mm. These kind of things, you know, I kind of slang too, because they say so much to me personally. And I'm always thanking God for the gift he gave me to remember all of these things. And I don't know when or where, but God, that's a lot to remember. There are some things that I don't think it's forgetting. It's just that I got so many to remember.
Well, I think it is a gift being a storyteller, right? Yeah. It's almost like it chooses you. Yeah, you don't actually have almost the choice anymore. Like, I feel like, I wanted to write plays and movies, and when I started writing songs, it became something else where I could not stop doing it even if I tried, right? It was something that you wake up in the middle of the night, something's hitting you, everything stops, and you have to write it down. You have to remember it because somehow feels important, even if it's not. If it's, you know,
I'm looking at you, Lou, you like, you're just me over, man. That's I couldn't say it any better because that's it, you know? I have this new record that I just got down to be out in the next couple months. It says, in a little shack down by the bay not far from New Orleans, I met this pretty woman down there, the finest thing I ever seen. She went and told her daddy she wanted to marry me. The look on her dad's face really was a sight to see. He said, get out of here with you, and don't you come back no more. Well, I wanted to meet her daddy like a young man ought to, but I know that he didn't want no blues singer to marry his daughter. Because when I went by his house that day, he met me at the door with her brother and sister, Big Bad John, the damn dog named Bo. He said, get out of here with you, and don't you come back no more. Well, I stooped down to get married, and the judge said, do you solemnly swear to take this woman for your lawful wife and not a one-night love affair? Before I could open my mouth to say I do, guess who walked to the door? Her dad, mom, Big Bad John, a dog named Bo. Well, I thought right then, if I wanted to get married to the girl, I got to find a way to elope. We decided to go to Las Vegas to get away from her nosy folk. Soon as I got to Las Vegas, soon we walked in, that was all the kin, all the friend, the damn dog again. Those are kind of things that I do, and you remind me of myself.
Is that based on a real story or something in your imagination?
Imagination, more or less. But I know of something like that with someone, but it's imagination to me because I know someone kind of went through that shotgun wedding kind of the bit, you know. But you remind me so much of me, man, as a young man.
Hey, I'll take it. Last night there was a house party that I played some of my own solo songs, which I don't normally do. And it's always amazing to me the difference between you playing in your room and then you playing in front of 150 people in an intimate environment. Right. And that adrenaline starts going.
That's right.
And a song I've been playing for 6-8 months, no problem. All of a sudden, you're changing lyrics on the fly.
That's right.
I'm like making edits. I'm like completely making up the second verse. It was like super weird.
That's right.
The brain almost like lifted out of my head and was like, oh, this song's going to be different now because now we got people listening.
That's right.
You know, it's crazy.
And you get vibes from listening. You can like read the vibes. I mean, you can really,
What's the way that you get... Do you get warmed up before a show? Do you get into a headspace where you're ready to share your stories?
I think about 30 to 40 minutes being alone. I'm a lonely kind of person with my music. Mm. And I do everything by myself. I don't need no company around me when I'm creating, when I'm doing what I'm doing. I guess, when you're into yourself and you get to... And you create, you know, musically and everything else. I can hear...
You got to be by yourself.
Well, I don't have to be by myself. I can be with someone, still be alone, because I can tune you out. You know how you, I can.
Well, because this is the only thing that matters right now, you know.
I'm alone.
Do you write better on the road or when you're home?
Oh, on the road. Every time I write better when I'm on the road, when I don't have a pen, everything come to you when you can't write it down.
Yeah, yeah.
Then you got to trust how you remember it.
Do you write stuff in a notebook?
Oh, on toilet tissue. Man, I got, paper, everything. On paper. I got paper everywhere. Don't throw anything away around me because I don't wrote on it, man.
I stopped a few years ago writing lyrics down on paper because I would lose it, and I now email myself.
Yeah.
Because then that song, you're like, oh, how did that go? And you're like, oh, I'm just going to type it into my email.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Because I would have journals or different stuff, and then I lose things. I always lose things.
But I got so many papers. I go, when I get ready to do something, I go through my paper and just throw it out on the floor. And I pick up a piece of paper. Mm. I find a verse here, a verse there. Oh, this is good with certain sets of things. You know, you find things. I just write things down.
What does the blues mean to you, like as an art form?
Blues mean everything to me, not just because I'm a blues singer, but I have gained enough knowledge about life now at my age, knowing where music as a whole blues come from. Mm-hmm. It's a root of all the music, all kinds of music, and gospel. Mm-hmm. But if you don't like the blues, you probably don't like your mama.
Okay. Elaborate.
It's the root of a lot of things come from the blues. And it's so meaning for me, singing the blues and being the black man who sang the blues, I get disturbed sometime about what critics goes about the blues. Mm. But I'm so glad that young white artists and blues singers and players is picking up the blues. Mm. But then I'm sad about the young black men and women who distance themselves from the blues and thinking blues is something less than something else. I can understand the reason. Because the reason why is because the writers and the radios and everything like that talk about the blues being something great when white done it. When black done it, it's just something else. So they don't want to be involved with something, just something else.
Or that it's like an old-fashioned traditional thing that's not has anything to do with sort of awareness.
How many black men is your age thinking about what Willie Dixon done? You can count them. Hmm. Because they think it's about nothing. But it's been set in their mind for to think about it because it's been written about that. It was nothing. And most of the thing was nothing until the white guys done it. Because I remember when Wawa's come in, and most of the time it invented, so the white guys could play like the black guys.
The wah-wah pedals.
Yeah, wah-wah pedals. Yeah. But that's all great. But what bothered me about it now, the black guy behind the wah-wah trying to sound like a white guy who's trying to sound black.
That's insightful.
Yeah, yeah. But if it wasn't for the white guys who playing the blues and love the blues and doing what you're doing with the blues, what would the blues be? So I'm glad that somebody somewhere taking along. It's just that, just give credit what's due. Just give what's come from. Because, you know, when you I love Johnny Lane. Mm-hmm. But Johnny Lane is doing the new, you know, I didn't happen to. In a few years, you think he the one that originated it. Mm. You know, but yeah, it's cool.
Well, if
you
people know? Don't know the history of anything, you get into trouble, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And the farther away music is for me from some sort of blues backbone, the more empty it is.
Yeah, yeah. And,
you know, it's more just, bought. It's just,
yeah.
It's going to be gone. It's going to be flash in the pan. It's not, it doesn't have a spine to it.
I'm glad you said that because, see, the reason I talk about some of the things I talk about, Rena, I'm glad to talk to you about it because pretty soon, if you don't have you or people like you, the people who coming on 20 years from now won't even know where this music come from and who did it and why.
But it's all the I think it's. I always say you got it. You can't blame young kids for their bad music taste. You blame their parents.
Blame the parents,
right? My dad gave me Robert Johnson's King of the Delta Blues on vinyl when I was like 8. You know, that was like a thing that was just in my house. You know, it wasn't the only thing we listened to, but it was like this is important.
That one thing he was into is important.
This is important. Listen to this, and that was like a thing that was just sort of like I was told was important. You know, and I think. Especially in American, you know, music creators, it's like if you're not somewhat aware of where all this music came from, you don't know anything in That's a way. Right. You know, you just know sort of whatever's on the radio right now.
You know, I was talking to my manager, Jeff, who's
just a good man.
A good man. And I'm so glad that we're putting this tour together solo because I can get a chance to really tell the story of me and many men before me. Mm-hmm. I don't have to say, I just do it. At my age, if I just do it, then people can see through what I'm doing, where I come from, and what the music I'm singing, and the grandfather and the own back and back and back. And people can say, well, they don't even have to like me. I strive to be good at what I'm doing. You can say, well, I don't like Obama Rush. But damn, he good.
Yeah,
that's all what matters.
Yeah. Well, I think when you're a storyteller deep down, right?
Yeah.
The story is more important than that, you, right?
You're right.
And it's like I actually get just as much joy when someone else sings my song.
Uh huh. Right? Yeah. Yeah.
Because I'm about like
that's a story.
See how she's doing that? Like.
Yeah.
And I remember because I've written plays and stuff, the most like the happiest I've ever been.
Yeah.
Standing in the back.
Yeah.
Of the audience in New York, watching them watch this
show.
And every night the reaction would be different, right? Some night they'd be roaring with laughter. The next night it would be dead silent. And every audience would experience this same story completely differently, right?
Right.
And that's why, like, for me, lyrics, I feel like, can be interpreted in so many ways.
That's right. That's why.
So... The title track of your newest album, Porcupine Meat.
Oh, okay. Man. It was hard. It was hard to get that
just
over.
The name of that kind of conjures this sort of strange divide where you're like, well, you're not going to eat a porcupine.
That's right, right.
But I want to know more about that.
And plus, I wasn't talking about porcupine meat.
Yeah.
I was talking about being in a situation in love with someone that you love more than they love you. And you knew it. But that was something about the person you didn't want to divide from. Mm. Hoping some way, if you just lay in there long enough, you would gain the love. Mm. And you figure if you leave too soon, that this person will realize who you was and how you felt about him, but it'd be too late. Otherwise, you'd be gone to someone else, and she'd be gone to someone else, or what have you.
How's that song start?
It's on, I'm in love with the woman. I know she don't mean me no good. I would leave the woman if I could. I tried to leave her many times before. But every time I leave, I come back for more. Now, that's porcupine meat. It's too fat to eat and too lean to throw away.
and it's pretty prickly on the outside.
Yeah, yeah. Pretty prickly too, you know.
Yeah. See, why aren't lyrics, but especially blues lyrics, appreciated like poetry? That's what I want to know. Because I used to read Langston Hughes growing
up.
You would read these phrases said as poetry.
Yeah, right. Well, that's what song's about. It really is, really, you know. When I was on Chicken Heads, Calvin Carter with BJ Records, I came, you know, I'm often coming up with these lyrics. I can talk to you kind of straight, and I can't talk to everybody like I'm talking to you because you're a writer, you know. And I said, I have this song, man. I think it's going to be a great song. So what's the name of it? I said, Chicken Head. Mm-hmm. So Leo Austell was his business partner. He was a Jehovah's Witness preacher. Mm-hmm. At that time, he said, oh, no, we can't cut no song, no Chicken Head. Now, he was thinking about, you know.
Too scary.
Yeah, too scary. Can't take a chance with that. He said, you mean Chicken Head? I said, yeah, Chicken Head. And I looked at him. I said, yeah, Chicken Head. He said, oh, yeah, you're from down south. They eat chicken heads down south. He said, how'd the song go? I said, Daddy told me on the dying bed, give up your heart, but don't you lose your head. You came along, what did I do? I lost my heart, and my head went too, which had nothing to do with the chicken. He said, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You follow me?
Yeah.
He said, but we need a B-side. I said, I got a B-side. He said, what's the name of it? I said, Mary Jane. He said, oh, yeah, I had a woman did me wrong named Mary Jane. And I wasn't talking about a woman at all.
Yeah.
So I had me two guys.
Smoke and mirrors.
Yeah, yeah. So they know what I was talking about. So that's kind of like when I did. I had this new record I have now. I never said this on the air or with anyone interview. The name of this new record I'm coming out with now.
You're getting an exclusive here on Show on the
Road. Called Dog Named Bo.
Oh, yeah. But it's not fully about the dog named Bo.
Well, you know, it's talking about this. I went by this main house, and he didn't want me to marry his daughter because I'm a blues singer. He sicked the dog on me.
Right.
Made him tear off all my clothes. Now, this is a dog named Bo, you know. Because I went on to get married to him. That means I made up with Bo. Me and Bo's all right.
If you could set up a tour with three artists, dead or alive, to join you on a tour, who would it be?
Probably be Tina Turner.
Tina Turner.
B.B. King.
Nice.
Probably Elton John.
Elton John?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
You dig Elton John's music?
It ain't the music. I like where he stands, where he's coming from, musically and on the stage.
Mm. I love that he keeps retiring, and then he unretires.
But I like the way he lies and get out of it. You know, he's been lied by retirement how many times? About 100.
When are you going to retire?
I'm like Elton John. So
every year is my retirement show.
Yeah.
Well, there was a comedian, an Australian comedian, who had this funny thing where, and she's young, but she's like, it's my going away tour. Like, I'm quitting comedy after this.
Yeah.
And then she would be like, well, I'm not actually quitting comedy. I'm just getting people interested. Because if you can get people to think that this is the only time you're ever going to see this the rest of your life.
But, you know, it's unfair to tell. I got so many artists that I respect, you know. Taj Mahal out here, and I can respect what he do and what he done. Mm-hmm. Great for Dead, that all of you not together now, but a lot of the guys that I know from big groups and big rock groups.
You played with Dr. John on the Decisions album,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, Dr. John with Decisions, you know.
Tell me about that song, Another Murder in New Orleans. That was awesome.
Carl Gustafson was doing this song, and we was in the studio. He said, man, I'd like to get Dr. John on this song. I said, give him a call. Tell him I'm at the studio. He called, and he said, hey, what's your name? He said, Carl Gustafson, I'm here with Bobby Rush. You here with Bobby? What's that Bobby Rush doing? You see, he's right here right now. I got on the phone. He said, what you doing? I said, I'm going to have time to record. How long are you going to be in town? I said, not too long, man. Just long as you get down here, I'm on my way. Not talking about no record, no recording, anything.
Yeah.
Comes in the studio with me because of a long-time relationship. We was doing this song.
Mm-hmm.
He said, man, what you want me to do? And this off the cuff.
Mm-hmm.
No plans, nothing. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Come, that's how it happens. Friendship. So I have this friendship, man.
What other good collaborations that you can remember?
Oh, I remember so many things. I mean, Chuck Berry was my sure enough friend.
In Chicago?
No, he was in St. Louis.
Oh, okay.
He used to live in St. Louis. I met him in Chicago, but mm-hmm. I played his birthday party for him many times.
He's kind of a prickly guy, right?
Yeah, but he never was at his party. What a funny guy. Played his birthday party, and he never was at either one of them.
He didn't come to his own party?
No. The last one I did, with, I said I wasn't going to do anymore, and I didn't do anymore. He come to me and said, Barbara Rush, I'm going to pay you. We're going to have some fun tonight. This is on Friday night. He get on this old tractor out in his farm, and I could see him going down twice the woods. I don't know what way he turned.
Yeah.
I don't see him no more in a week.
Where'd he go?
I don't know. Who knows? His birthday party. A lot of folks there. Mm. Do it every year. Have his birthday party. So y'all just have fun. I'm going to the store. I'll be right back. With his tractor. You know, he's a farm guy. I don't know. He must have a truck down the
woods. What was he farming down there?
Everything. Just grass and peanuts and butter beans and shit, you know.
Take the tractor and not come back to your birthday party.
Yeah. But he was a good guy, you know. But I got so many guys that I love and respect. Buddy Guy's another guy who's been a loyal friend to mine for a long, long time. And I'm hoping somewhere down the line we get to record some thing together because we've been on each other from the same home state and the whole bit. I do so many things with him, and we just love each other. And
who's this?
Buddy Guy.
Mm.
And there's so many guys that I like to do some things with. You asked me earlier.
Yeah.
But I pinned down three or four people because you gave me three. But it's so many guys.
Mm.
So many guys that I respect and love the music and what they've done. If you listen to Barbara Ray's song, you hear a little of this and a little of that and a little of this and a little of that. You put it all in a bowl and you stir it up. You got a Barbara Ray soup, you know. And so many guys I respect, you know, and down to the younger guy, the Prince, the Snoop Dogg, the Hoarder. You know, I don't endorse all the things the rappers do and the pants down a whole bit. I don't get into that. But some of the guys do some great music and some great businessmen.
Mm.
Because my attitude is about if you mad about the pants being down, all you got to do is lift the head level up and the pants will come with it.
Okay.
You know? And although those are my attitude, because music is music to me. If it did well, you know, it may not be my cup of tea of music, but if it did well, I can respect it.
Mm-hmm. How do you feel like the music industry has changed in your many decades doing it?
I think this music haven't really changed. I think the blues, we're talking about the blues itself, I think the blues to the black people is outdated, and to the young white people is something new.
Mm.
I don't think the white guys understand that the black guys not doing it because they think it's something old to do or something they cool to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the young white guys and kids will think that something blues is something to do now. And I'm thinking in my heart that the blacks just don't want to do the blues because it's not swift enough for them. It's not good enough for them. Because I respect all the blues players around the country and what they're doing. But I'm a little bit different from most of the guys. I'm a storyteller.
Mm-hmm.
I'm about the blues. I love the blues. But I'm about doing it correct.
Mm. What does that mean?
The bars and what have it. A lot of guys come, even when John Lee would do, I respect John Lee. But he wouldn't.
He never went to the five. He just kept going.
I didn't see that. That don't mean he's wrong.
Yeah.
It just that I want to kind of do it on scales and bars and counts and whatever.
Yeah.
That don't mean I'm right about it, you know. It's just my feeling about it, you know. They made good living with it, so be it, you know.
Well, I remember trying to learn some of the blues stuff when I was in college and listening to John Lee Hooker. I can hear the band actually going to the four
to
chord,
the four,
and he's staying
he's
on the one.
He's staying on one. Staying on
and
the
I was
one.
Like, wait, what? But it has this kind of dissonance that's really spooky and cool.
Yeah.
And when he sort of ends the song, it's like the song isn't really over.
Yeah.
It's
a comma most of the time. Yeah. It's not a period.
Yeah.
On most of the things, it's everything ends with a comma. Not with a period.
And I like, you know, creating songs with a little more structure.
Yeah, yeah.
A couple verses.
Yeah. Yeah.
Chorus and the bridge.
I don't mean we write about it. It's just that.
But know. I think when I first started writing songs, I heard Bob Dylan's Blonde on Blonde record, and he would take sort of these songs like Visions of Johanna.
Yeah, yeah.
That sort of went on as long as they needed the story to be told.
How many bars it take to tell the story, that's how many bars you use.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you and I write, like, I got to write this story within these bars, you know?
Well, there's a certain kind of, like, pleasure to getting the rhyme in this exact
timing.
Yeah, you know? And then when you can really, and the English language is such a beautiful sort of thing for that, because you can find all these ways of looping things in this awesome way that is somehow exciting, even though it's been done a million times before.
That's right. You know, and you know, as you go along doing the interviews and you go along doing show, you always find a passion with someone who relate to you and what you do. This is an easy interview with me because you understand as a writer.
Well, I appreciate you, man.
As a writer, because you understand the spaces, you know what I'm talking about, and what I think, and as a writer, you know, you can relate to that. And most guys would ask me about some situation just because they want to learn about what I thought about it. Because what I think about a situation don't mean it's right. It's just my opinion, you know, just my opinion. And there's so many guys that I love to work with through the years, and so many places I've been. I wish I'd been the time that worked with Louis Jordan, who I analyzed as a writer.
Louis Jordan, yeah.
Yeah, Junior Parker.
Louis Jordan's almost like the bridge between jazz and rock and roll and blues, right? Like, you can see it happening. And he was doing it, in the early 50s? I mean, it was way before.
So when you listen to the Bobby Rush record, you hear some modification. In what I do, I'm a blues man who modified some licks and some timing and what I am and what I'm doing. At one time, I was so far in ahead of myself until it seemed like I wasn't playing the blues.
But I was using a lot of synthesizers and stuff in the 80s. So.
I did that because that was a modification. That was the telephone. Now what I was doing then, someone was kicking about it, but now look how we've done this interview now. Look at this modification.
Well, we're going back a little more rustic
Well, this is what we're doing. This is what I was doing. Because, see, I knew it was going to come a time that scent is one thing and real music is another thing. But now it gets to the place you can't hardly tell scent from the real music if it's did in music patterns. Mm-hmm. You follow me? Because I remember when I was a kid, I went outside to a toilet because we didn't have no inside toilet. It didn't smell good. Now I got 9 bathrooms in my house. They smell good.
You have 9 bathrooms?
Yeah, but the point of getting to is you do the same thing in them. That haven't changed.
It's true. You know, if I work hard enough, you know, till I'm 84, you know, maybe I can also have 9 bathrooms.
Yeah.
I don't. Maybe I just need 3.
But you have to have money to buy food and have a use for the bathroom.
What's your favorite food on the road when you're traveling?
Probably a good salad and
good salad.
Yeah, good. Not that much meat.
That's why you look so good.
Yeah, a good salad and not that much meat. If it's flies or swim, I eat it.
Do you exercise? Do you have stuff to keep you fit?
Yeah, I exercise. You know, I exercise, and then I stay pretty. I don't exercise like as much as I should, but I'm pretty.
You cook when you're home?
Yeah, I cook. I cook when I'm not home that much. But
what's your signature dish?
Probably, I cook a lot of vegetables, greens and peas and beans and stuff. Stay away from the meat stuff and a lot of vegetables.
He's going to live to 110 years old, I think.
Oh, no, not that much bread, no rice, no potatoes, nothing like that.
Do you think you're still going to be playing the blues when you're 100?
Yeah.
Who is the oldest touring guy right now? Isn't like Pine Top Perkins? He was really old.
Yeah,
right?
Pine Top was working with me. He was still a touring. Maybe not in touring. I haven't did under 200 shows a year for 65 years.
200 shows a year.
For 65 years. Haven't did under 200 for 65 years.
Does your voice ever get tired?
Yeah. I get tired mentally, and that's when my voice gets tired.
But traveling is the toughest part.
Yeah, you know, every now and then I have the little up, the little down strokes. It's a personal thing that I go through, but not too many of them. Because my prayer is all the time that I hope God keep me enthused, because a man can live a long time without water or food, but you can't live long without hope. So I'm always have hope and already learning. Like today, this is the interview, but I'm learning something, you know. I tell you this, when you told me that you was out of Chicago and you're a young man, so the first thing I said, where are you from? He said, he's out of Chicago. I asked him, how old is he? I said, he's about 50, 60 years old. He said, no. He's about 30, 35 in that range. That's what my manager told me.
34 next week.
Yeah, listen. I was interested to talk to anyone who out of Chicago that love the blues at 30-something years old. That's a rare thing.
Well, my dad plays blues harmonica in the band sometimes. When we're in town in Chicago, he'll come up and play a tune. We'll do sometimes a Muddy Waters tune or something of mine. I wanted to ask you about the harmonica because it's something that's hard to teach because it's inside your mouth, right?
Yeah.
So I remember asking my dad, like, so how do you bend the notes like that? And he's sort of like, I don't know, just try it out. You know, like, how do you demonstrate that if someone wants to, like, it's almost like a feeling thing.
It's a feel thing, but it could be demonstrated. It can tell, you know.
Can you demonstrate a couple things on harp?
Well, let me see. I had one here.
They're a dem. Because I feel like there's a mournfulness and an emotion.
My harmonica can play a little bit different from most guys because I'm a right-hand person, but I do everything left-handed.
Really?
Yeah.
It's like a baseball player.
Yeah. You know, and the reason why I do the harmonica left-handed, because I had the chicken pop when I was a little young boy.
Okay.
And I didn't want to wait till the chicken pop got well on my side of my mouth, so I reversed the harp the other way.
You couldn't wait? Yeah.
Yeah, I couldn't wait till then, and I learned to play, you know.
Was that the first thing you started playing before the guitar?
Juice harp. Juice harp, man. Juice harp, playing the country. Mm-hmm. You know, listening to Johnny Cash. That was a song I was crazy about. You get the hook and I get the pole, babe. You get the hook and I get the pole. We going down to crawl that hole. Honey, baby, my.
A lot of bluegrass players play that.
Yeah. But I.
What brand do you play? You play Horner?
I play Horner. I play Lee Oscar, who's my old buddy. He got some things that he's doing now in the low C's, the low E's, the low B's. That's another thing. You know, that's real low.
You remember the first song you played on harmonica?
Yeah. Yeah, my dad, harmonica played my dad. Train. Train and the Hound Dog.
How's that go?
My dad said, son, let me tell you about this train and the hound dog had a race. I asked my dad, so how did it wind up? He said, who you think won the race? I said, oh, the train. He said, no. He said, the dog said, oh, wow. And he went on to show me the dog went on to win the race. Dog was there. And he said the dog went so far in ahead of the train, he turned around and came back and it ran over his tail. That's where Albert Kane got the song from, about the dog ran across the railroad track, cut his tail off. And he would holler and say, ooh. My daddy kind of taught me that, man. And he talked it to me while he was doing it.
You ever hear that? Remember that band, Jay Giles Band?
Yeah.
Magic Dick and the Lickin' Stick?
Yeah.
Remember, I always tried to get my dad to sing, to play Whammer Jammer.
Whammer Jammer.
It's like one of the only, like, rock and roll harmonica hits, you know? That song is so hot.
But it was so old and hot and was played well, you know?
I always break the reeds in mine. Like every time in the middle.
You got to get you. They got the better brands of hops. Some these are a little better brands of hops. It's old, but it's got the good reason, and it costs a little bit more money. You know, just like a car, you put a little more money into the hop and get a better bridge and get better notes and so on. But if you're talking about bending, if you're talking about the third note, it's this. And most of the time, you say blow your hop, but it's about 30% blows, about 70% draw. That's for Bobby Rush.
And off you're going in.
I'm going in. If I was draw notes, and that's where the key come in.
Yeah, man. I mean, it feels like
now I can blow it the other way.
Feels like the train is inside the room.
Well, yeah, right. You know, you get.
People don't realize how loud these things are.
I came home last night. A woman wouldn't let me in. Went to the bedroom. She was making love to my best friend. That's a tough titty. And can't nothing suck it but a lion. I never will forget what I heard people through the window pane. She was making love to him, but she was calling out my name. That's a tough titty. Can't nothing suck it but a lion. You know that's a hard pill to try to swallow. Think about what she did to me all the time.
You ever think of making an album just voice and harmonica?
Yeah.
Who's that? There was an amazing harmonica player that did that. Totally blanking on his name. Well, I used to get a couple of his records.
I tell you who could do it well. I don't know where he had made a record like that. That was Sonny Boy Williams. He could do it well. And he played the low C's. That's what he played, a lot of the low C harps.
I love that. They used one of his songs in a David Lynch movie when the guy is beating up. He's trying to like beat up this guy, and it just goes into baby.
Yeah,
baby.
Yes.
So good.
Yeah. Sonny was both the guys, but I like the last Sonny Boy better than I did the Having Respect for him better than you.
Sonny Boy 3?
Yeah, 3.
Yeah.
He was a great player, man. Great player.
I have that vinyl with the top hat?
Yeah. Derby.
Yeah.
But I'm hoping you are let me say to you before we get off the interview, let me thank you for what you have done. Thank you for what you're doing.
It's not an
honor
to have
you. What you plan to do, because what you're doing, you give people the opportunity to keep the blues alive and the people who do the blues, and educate the people who don't know about it, what the blues was, what it is, what it would always be.
I mean, it's amazing to see young people taking it up. You know, there's a girl I had on this show named Sunny War, and it's like I don't know if you believe in past lives or reincarnation. It's like she's a young kid playing like Mississippi John Hurt, and you're like, where is this coming from? You know, it just is there inside people, you know?
Yeah.
You want to play a song?
Whatever you want me to do, man. You got your guitar here, huh? You don't gain relationship with me here, so
let's get the guitar out.
All right.
What do you want to play?
A little song about the lady that broke my heart. My baby left me here to cry. She didn't even tell me goodbye. I need some time, try to find where to get the woman out my mind. Drinking gin, I'm drinking wine, trying to get the woman out my mind. I need some time, oh, try to find where to get the woman out my mind. She left me for the week, says she won't be back no more. I need a little time, oh, to try to find where to get the woman out my mind. Think about the woman every night, wondering if she ever coming back. I need some time, oh, try to find where to get the woman out my mind. I need my woman to come back. Since she been gone, things ain't right. I need some time, try to find where to get the woman out of my mind.
Hey, this is Steve Choi, host of the Musicians Guild podcast, part of the Sound Talent Media podcast network. Within the four walls of the Musicians Guild, we'll be discussing the habits, idiosyncrasies, experiences, and general psychology of my friends and peers all involved with music in various capacities. Listen and subscribe at soundtalentmedia.com.